equipped with all the necessary tools to discuss interesting physics which happened in the early universe. And today, I would like to discuss in some detail the Big Bang nuclear synthesis, which is a very important event, and it actually imposes very strict constraints on fundamental physics, as we shall see. So part C, Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So please make sure that everybody has those pictures. And so basically what we are trying to explain is that if you imagine how the periodic table looks like, so approximately it looks like something like this, and then something smaller, and something bigger here, and then lots of crap here. So now there are two important things in this periodic table, and that's the hydrogen standing here, and the helium standing here. And so now if you measure, you know, how many elements in the universe are hydrogen, how many are helium, how many are something else, you find that basically everything is hydrogen and helium, and then everything else is just tiny little seasoning. So by mass, universe has the following composition, has so we have 75% of hydrogen, 25% of helium, and then 0% of everything else. Of course, this is true only if you average over the universe. So it's definitely not true on the Earth, where you know that you have lots of heavy elements. But if you take an average what's happening in the universe, this will be the average content of various things. So now, this is actually a very, very big puzzle, and it was studied in the mid of last century, so like 1950s and around, and there are these great physicists who try to explain abundance of these things. And so we have great physicists as Fermi, Bethe, Gamow, and Hoyle, and many others. Okay, and so what I would like to show you today is that, of course, there is a very complicated calculation which leads to this precise prediction, but I would rather like to show a back of the envelope calculation, basically doing no calculations at all, and sort of convincing you that, you know, we can get the right numbers. Okay, so we want to do back of the envelope calculation. And of course, you know, nowadays, people don't do these calculations anymore, really. But they rather try to do very complicated calculations, lots of calculations, without actually knowing the result beforehand by doing this very, very simple stuff. Okay? And so, if we go back to the mid of 20th century, then there were basically two theories which tried to explain this abundance of elements. So, theory number one was that all these elements were actually fused in stars. So, star fused in stars. And opposite to this theory was theory number two, which said, no, this wouldn't give the right prediction. This wouldn't give the right 75 and 25%. Rather, you have to have something else, some other fusion, if you want. And that was the Big Bang theory, basically. So Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So basically, saying that, yeah, the universe at the beginning was very, very hot. And so this provided enough of the right environment so that we can actually fuse elements in the early universe. Not in stars, but close to Big Bang. Okay? And so there are these two theories, and I would like to convince you today that probably the Big Bang nuclear synthesis is more correct than this one here. So let me first look at this theory one. And so just show you that really doesn't give you the right prediction even if you fiddle some numbers around. So you know that in your table, in your periodic table, you have lots of various elements, and some of them are stable and some of them are unstable. So the most stable one is the iron. So the iron is the most stable element, which means that if you are fusing, for example, hydrogen into helium, you are actually getting energy out of it. Okay, and similarly, if you are doing some other things with more heavy elements, you are still getting energy until the iron. And if you have elements which are heavier than that, actually, if you compose them together, you're actually losing energy. Or they are unstable. So they are radioactive and unstable. So up to this, we can cook elements thermodynamically if you want. And so it was precisely Hoyle and you know others who really show that in the middle of the star you have such high temperatures that yes, you can fuse these elements there in stars. Okay. And of course the bigger star you have, it is more massive, and so you have higher temperature inside it. And so you can fuse more things. So in stars, but they have to be sufficiently massive here. So then this would explain sort of the abundance of elements up to the iron in your periodic table. But you have also heavier elements, and which actually cannot be produced by these thermodynamic processes. And so that was a big puzzle, how you produce these heavier elements. And the answer is that you can still produce them, but it's something which is non-equilibrium process, something which is very violent process, and something which is very, very bad. So for example, when the supernova explodes. So if the supernova explodes, you create such an environment, such as big shocks, big pressures, and stuff like that, where you can create these more heavy elements. Okay, heavier. Heavy elements produced by shocks. For example, supernova explosion. Okay, so this is very nice theory number one. So that's the theory number one. And the question is, does it really explain the right abundance of these elements? And so let me look at these very, very light elements like helium or lithium or other. And so we would need to get 25% of helium fused in stars, if this theory is correct. Okay, so now the statement is, you cannot really do it. So let me write it. So cannot get the right abundance of light elements, especially like helium and lithium and beryllium and stuff like that. So to show you that this is the case, consider, for example, fusion of helium. So helium-4 has binding energy, which is like 28 MeV. So you now know that inside helium there's actually four well, two protons and two neutrons, so two baryons there. So that means that actually if you are fusing helium out of four baryons, then you are getting 28 divided by 4, which is 7 MeV, which is, there is this strange unit, which I'll be using because I want to use later on the Fermi's theory. Anyway, so, which is 10 to minus 5 ek per baryon. So this is how much you get energy per baryon if you fuse helium. Okay. So now what you want to really check is if it's possible to fuse 1/4 number of heliums, of baryons into helium. Okay. So if 1/4 of baryons fused into helium in stars. And let's say that this happened during the lifetime of the universe. So our universe is approximately, I don't know, 10 billion years old. So let's say it could have happened any time in the history of the universe. So during last 10 to the 10 years. Okay, so any time in the history of the universe. Then what you can calculate is something which astronomers really like, and that's the luminosity to mass ratio. So how much luminosity you get per mass of a star, if you want, inside the universe. So then, luminosity to mass ratio can be calculated as, so we have how much energy per second. So luminosity has units of energy per second. So how much, you know, how much is the power, how much energy we are getting outside of the star, and per mass of the baryon. So now we want that 1/4 of baryons actually is fused. So the total mass is just, well, okay, 10 to minus 5 ek. This is the energy produced by fusing one baryon per baryon fusing. I cannot say that. It's the energy which you are getting by fusing helium per baryon. Okay, so 10 to minus 5 ek. So now if you want the luminosity, you divide energy per time. Okay, so it's now 10 to the 10 years here, which is 3 times 10 to the 17 seconds. So this is the luminosity. And then the mass is 4 times mass of the proton, which is, you know, how many total mass I'm getting into fusing the helium. And if you calculate this ratio, you find that this is 2.5 L star, where this is the luminosity of the sun per mass of the sun. Okay. So now, so this is huge luminosity, and which would be an average in our universe. So if this were true, our night wouldn't be dark, but rather we would have really, really bright nights, because the observed luminosity per mass in our universe, so observed, is actually 200 times smaller. So observed is 0.05. L star, L sun over M sun. Okay, so this means dark night. This means very, very bright night. So what you can see from here is that this is your maximum limit you can produce your helium, and this is the required limit to get 25%. So if you take the ratio of these things, you find that at most 0.5% of helium is fused in stars. not 25%, but 0.5%. Okay, so this very, very simple calculation shows you that, you know, it cannot be so. So certainly, some helium was fused in stars, but it's not enough to explain the abundance of helium in our universe. Question? Yes?
You see that 10 to the minus 5 Erg on the top of that fraction?
Yes.
And
so the luminosity is energy per time. So this is my energy I'm getting out of that per baryon.
Yeah, okay, so that.
And this is the time.
Is that the same as the 10 to the minus 5 Ergs per baryon at the top?
Yes.
So that's the energy in the helium, but why is it contributing to the luminosity?
I'm saying if all, you know, if I turned all that energy into luminosity, of course, there's some assumption there, but I'm basically turning all the fused energy into light.
Okay.
If you want. Yes.
And the 1/4 in front of that fraction, are those the 25% or 4 baryons?
So I'm fusing 4 baryons into 1 helium. So this is energy per baryon, and I'm fusing four things into one. Is that correct?
So where does the 25% come from?
I'm saying that's that 1/4. Maybe so.
So 10 to the minus 5 is already divided by 4.
That's already divided by 4. You're right. So sorry. So that's the 25%. I'm sorry. So this is the 25%. OK.
And the 0.5%, is that the mass over the total mass of the universe, or the mass over the mass of helium that's observed?
Once more, is the mass...
The 0.5%, is that the percentage of helium observed or percentage of baryons?
So those 35% there is really how much mass in the baryons is in helium.
Yeah.
So it's by mass. It's not that I have 25%. Yeah.
I think this might be the same question, but... So that 0.5%, is that putting a limit, saying that 0.5% of that 25%?
Yeah. So this is the maximum limit I could do.
Okay.
Right. So this is really what is observed, the luminosity to mass ratio, and you know so this is maximum number of helium I can do it here.
So you can get maximum 0.5% of the universe is helium. You're not saying 0.5% of 25%.
No, 0.5. Well, do it yourself if you...
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe I'm cheating here a little bit, but I think, you know, more or less it's correct. So anyway, there is this theory, but it doesn't predict the right number of helium, which is observed here. So now... let me show you that the theory number 2, if you fiddle with the constants and with the calculation enough, then actually you get the right number. And of course, I'll be doing lots of modifications of these numbers so that it works. So you have to trust me that even if you did it actually exactly, it would still work. Okay, so now Big Bang, so theory number 2, So if you go back to, let's say, temperatures of the early universe when you were at temperatures 10 GeV or something like that, of course, every particle which you know is at the time sort of relativistic. So the protons are relativistic, neutrons are relativistic, and so on. And this is true until about 1 GeV, when your protons and neutrons start to be non-relativistic. And so once the protons and neutrons stop to be relativistic, their density start behaving like for non-relativistic particles, so they sort of decay. The number of neutrons and the number of protons is decay. Okay? And so there's this big puzzle still, and it's precisely at the time when actually the protons and antiprotons sort of annihilated, neutrons and antineutrons annihilated and so on. And there is this question why we still have some matter left, which I mentioned yesterday. So there's this is a big puzzle of baryogenesis, saying, you know, I have 10 to 9 plus 1 proton and 10 to 9 antiprotons. And the question is where this asymmetry actually comes from. Okay, in any case, in the end, when all these protons sort of annihilate, you still have some protons left, but you have lots of gamma as well, which was produced by this annihilation. And so that's the origin of basically eta number. So we have this eta number, which plays actually quite, which is the number of baryons divided by number of gamma, and it's something like 10 to minus 9. So you have 10 to minus 9 less baryons than photons. And so this ratio eta actually plays an important role in the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which I, however, will not show to you. I will just, you know, mention that it is so. So it plays an important role in Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And I will tell you where it plays the role and, you know, when exactly it should enter the calculation, but we are not going to really enter that calculation. Okay, but I'll give you, in the end, I will give you a picture which tells you, yeah, so this really is eta dependent. Okay, so now this happens at about 1 GeV. So now the temperature still keep decreasing, and for us, what is most interesting is when the temperature is few MeV. So if the temperature is few MeV, then what happens is that the weak interactions become inefficient. So basically, anything regarding neutrinos becomes, you know, sort of stops. And so it has two consequences. The consequence number one is that neutrinos decouple. From thermal bars. And second is that there is no more chemical equilibrium between protons and neutrons. So no longer chemical equilibrium between protons and neutrons. Okay. So now these two events don't happen exactly at the same time. But I will sort of estimate, you know, when one of these happens, and easier to estimate is actually this one here. And then I'll say, well, the other one happens approximately, you know, in the same temperature. Okay, so let me estimate this when the neutrinos actually decouple from the thermal bars. And you will do a little bit more exactly this calculation in your tutorial today. I will do it very crudely. And then I'll say the other one, which is actually more interesting for our Big Bang nucleosynthesis, happens exactly, you know, approximately at the same temperature. Okay, so neutrino decoupling so before the neutrinos decouple they are in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the bars by reactions something like that. So you have, for example, neutrino interacting with antineutrino, and it gives you electron and positron, or, you know, variations of this reaction. So you can have electron plus neutrino, and gives you another neutrino and electron, and so on. Okay, and so in this, then, of course, this is electroweak interactions, and you have some H bosons entering these things. But at these temperatures, it's not really important. And what you can do is that you can approximate these reactions by Fermi theory to something simpler, like a tree diagram. So approximate by Fermi theory and so you know that this Fermi theory has, so you play, it replace the electric weak coupling constant G with some other coupling constant which is now dimension full. So we have Fermi coupling constant GF, which is something like, if you know small g, which is the electro weak coupling constant, and then you divide it by the mass of your cage boson, let's say W square, and it's something like 10 to the minus 5 GeV minus 2. Okay, so that's your coupling constant, which is, you know, it works very well for the Fermi theory approximation. And you can sort of justify why it has to be m square, because it comes from the propagator of W, and this is your coupling constant. And now basically you are forgetting that there's two interactions. You replace them by one. So that's why you have g square here. Okay, so you are forgetting the propagator of W, and you are forgetting the interactions here. Okay, so this is your Fermi coupling. And then you might be interested, what is the reaction rate of these reactions? And so gamma. So now here, you know, if you have temperatures few MeV, all these things which enter the reaction are still relativistic. So electrons are relativistic, neutrinos are relativistic, everything is relativistic. So basically the only thing which has the units of energy is the temperature. Okay? So I know that the reaction rate, which is basically if you calculate the amplitude square, so amplitude will be proportional to GF, but amplitude square is GF square. Okay, so the reaction rate must be given by GF square. And then you have to have the right units. And the only thing which you can use is the temperature to get the right units. It must be GF square times T to the appropriate power, so that you get number of reactions per second, so 1 over second, basically. Okay? And so the right number of these is t to the 5. So you can sort of estimate that the reaction rate is given by gf square t to the 5 just by dimensional analysis. Okay? So now you want to, of course, estimate when the neutrinos decouple, meaning when the Hubble rate is approximately equal to your reaction rate gamma. Okay? So for the Hubble rate, we have our Friedmann equation, rho minus k over a square. So now I told you that k is approximately 0, so we will neglect k. So this term is not there. And so this is equal to 8 pi g Newton over 3. And so now the density, which we studied yesterday, so it's given, so everything is radiation here regarding these things. So it's in the radiation era. So it's just given by the formula which we wrote down yesterday. It's pi square 30, and then there's this number of spins, and then we have t to the 4. Okay. So now in these units, when I'm using really that's just minus 5 GeV square, you can also write the Newton constant as given by 1 over m Planck square. Okay? So I can replace G Newton by 1 over m Planck square. So G Newton m Planck square. Okay? And then you can calculate how many species are really relativistic, and how many species contribute to your radiation. So you can calculate this G star, and for this period, you will show today in your tutorial, it's approximately 10. Okay, so this number G star is approximately 10. Okay, so in other words, you have something which is some number here, and then you have t to the 4, and then m Planck square, and then this number is something which is known to us. You can exactly calculate it. Okay, so now imposing that h is approximately gamma, we have that, well, gamma is gf square t to the 5, and h is of course square root of this thing here. So it's again some number, some other number to 1/2 if you want, and then t square, and then m Planck. Okay, and so by solving this equation, we find when exactly, for which temperature these reactions, you know, ceased, and this reaction, when the neutrinos decouple. So from here, you can find that T is approximately 1 MeV. Okay, so at temperature 1 MeV, the neutrinos decoupled. Okay. Very, very crude estimate, but it's approximately correct. Okay, so we have neutrino decoupling. So now, if you look at the path 2, I'll say, well, the protons and neutrons decoupled approximately at the same temperature, but you can show that they decoupled a little bit later. So I will alter this 1 MeV to something a little bit smaller so that it works, okay? So you have the chemical equilibrium, between protons and neutrons is given by reactions like proton eats electron, gives you neutron and some neutrino, and so on. So again, the neutrinos play an important role here. And so you can show that if there is, you know, if the neutrinos are sort of decoupled in those reactions, they will be also decoupled in these reactions. Okay? So, but a little bit later. So I will take that, you know, these stop when the temperature is a little bit lower than this 1 MeV. And the correct estimate to get the right number is 0.8. MeV. So the chemical equilibrium is no longer maintained below this temperature, 0.8 MeV. Okay. So now the question is, you know, how many, what is the ratio of protons and neutrons at this temperature? So before this temperature, you know, for temperatures higher than that, you have thermal equilibrium. So I can still use, you know, thermal equilibrium formula to calculate how many neutrons versus protons are there. Okay? And so for that, you just use the Boltzmann law. So use Boltzmann law. Law to determine number of neutrons divided by number of protons. And of course, this is proportional to the exponential minus the difference in energies divided by the corresponding temperature. So now the difference in energies is, of course, given by the difference in masses of neutrons and protons. So Q is mass of the neutron minus mass of the proton. And you can convert it to the right units. And it's something like 1.3 MeV. Okay, so now I just take this Q over T and take the exponential of that, of course, and then you get something like 1 over 6. So there is 6 times less neutrons at the time than protons. Okay, so that is the case at that temperature 0.8 MeV. Okay. But after the temperature 0.8 MeV, neutrons and protons are completely decoupled. So what happens is that they sort of roam free, protons roam free, and neutrons roam free. But protons are stable, but neutrons are not. So after this, proton stable. And so their number is not really changing, but neutrons decay. And of course, they decay by the exponential law. So by e to minus t over the lifetime of neutron. So the lifetime of neutron is something like 15 minutes. Okay, so the ratio of protons and neutrons is changing now. Okay, and so you don't have much, you know, so if you wait long time, then there will be no neutrons left. So you have to wait exactly the right time to get precisely, you know, the right number of neutrons. And so it turns out that the right time is something like 3 minutes. So at about 3 minutes after the Big Bang. So all these things, so when you have these MEVs and stuff like that, this is very, very early after Big Bang. It's like 1 second after Big Bang. So this is suddenly, you know, 3 minutes. So that this ratio actually significantly changes, but not really. You still have some neutrons left. At about 3 minutes, this ratio changes to 1/7. So n neutrons and protons is something like 1/7. If you plug in, you know, this lifetime 15 minutes, and then you use t to 3 minutes, then you get that thing. Okay. So an interesting question is why you are waiting here. Okay, so why the neutrons suddenly when they sort of roam free, they just, you know, two neutrons don't become friends with two protons and form a helium right now after this is happening. And the right answer is that actually everything is much more complicated, and you cannot really fuse two neutrons and two protons into helium in one reaction. Okay, so this wave is connected to a very interesting phenomenon, which is called bottleneck, deuterium bottleneck. And so what basically has to happen is that you cannot fuse two neutrons and two protons into helium directly, but you first have to create deuterium. So first you fuse deuterium, and once you have lots of deuterium, you fuse that deuterium to helium. So basically deuterium gives you helium, but neutrons and protons don't give you helium immediately. So you have to wait until you have enough deuterium, and then you can finally fuse helium. Okay. So now what happens is that the fusion of deuterium, and I'm not going to explain it here, but this reaction, well, so need enough deuterium. Okay. But to create deuterium, the reaction is actually suppressed by that eta, which I mentioned at the beginning. So need enough deuterium, but its creation is suppressed. By eta. Maybe I'll put it into your homework to show this. Okay, so that's really, if you want to find the right amount of deuterium, you will see that there is the total factor of eta standing in front of your reaction rate, if you want. Okay, so there's this number 10 to minus 9. And because that number is really, really small, it takes a long time to create enough deuterium. So that's why you are waiting here those 3 minutes, because you simply don't have enough deuterium to start using helium. Okay, so but at the end of these 3 minutes, yes, you have enough deuterium, and once you create enough deuterium, this deuterium actually immediately fuses into helium. So once enough of deuterium, then immediately, basically all of deuterium fuses into helium. Okay. And that's why you have to wait those 3 minutes. Okay, so now we know all the story. So now let's calculate what is the fraction. How much helium we really produced here. And so we know that the helium, I mentioned that many times, is 2 protons plus 2 neutrons. So the mass of the helium is 4 times, well, I'll not really distinguish the mass of the neutron and proton now. So it's 4 times mass of the proton. But the total mass in helium is this, well, this is mass density times the number of neutrons divided by, so this is like mass density, probably, divided by this number of neutrons divided by volume. So yeah, so it might divide by volume, it's better. Okay, so now the fraction of how much helium you have with respect to how many baryons you have. So this is 2 times MP times the number of neutrons. And so the total fraction is 2 times MP number of neutrons. And the total mass in baryons is just mass of the proton and number of protons and number of neutrons. Okay, so there's this 2. But I calculated what is the number of neutrons versus the number of protons. And so I'm saying that this is approximately equal to 1 over 7. So now if you plug it here, so you just take the ratio here everywhere, and you find that it's this 1 plus 7, which is precisely 1 over 4, which is 25% of helium. Of course, I tuned all the numbers so that it gives you exactly 25%. So it's lots of cheating here. But basically, yeah, if you do the correct calculation, it gives you the right thing. OK, so.
Why is that in the definition of the mass for the helium, we have 4 mass problem times?
So this is not really mass of the helium. So the mass in one helium is 4 times MP. Yeah. So now if I want the mass of total helium in the universe, it's times the number of neutrons divided by 2, because I eat two neutrons per helium.
Okay.
So this is really mass per volume or something like that.
Okay.
It's proportional, let's say. But I'm using the same trick for baryons here as well. So it'll be, again, proportional to one. But so the last line is correct, and this is proportional to two. Okay. So let me summarize this calculation. So by the picture which I gave you, so really there's a few steps what's actually happening. So maybe I'll use this one here. And that picture summarizes everything. So it's the first picture in your handout. So you start with the equilibrium situation. And so I will track the number, let's say, of neutrons. So in equilibrium, so again, this will be the abundance per A cube or something like that. So the number of neutrons in equilibrium, and they are relativistic, so it's just a constant here. Okay, and then they become non-relativistic at some point. So the neutrons become non-relativistic, and if they become non-relativistic, they would start decaying by this exponential decay law. Okay. However, this is not happening for all the time, but the neutrons stop to be in equilibrium with protons because the neutrinos decouple. Okay, so that happens, let's say here. So this is neutron decoupling, which precisely corresponds to neutrino decoupling, sort of. Neutrino decoupling. But basically, there's no this reaction which would change neutrons into protons and so on. So at that point, actually, the neutrons decouple. Okay, and then you would know that if nothing was happening, if the neutron was stable, then again the density per a cube would remain constant. But the neutrons are not stable, so instead of having a constant, you sort of have this exponential decay here again. So this is decay of neutrons as e to minus t over tau. Okay, so the number of neutrons is decreasing; it doesn't remain constant. So in the meantime, actually the deuterium starts fusing. So this is the deuterium thing. And if you have enough deuterium, then suddenly all these neutrons fuse into helium. So the neutrons go down. There's no more neutrons left. All of them are fused into helium. Deuterium goes down because now it's all fused. But I have helium emerging. Okay, and so this is basically the roadmap to the calculation, if you want. So really, what you have to do is you have to estimate at what temperature the decoupling occurred, and we estimated, well, we used slightly different reaction, but we estimated 1 MeV, but then he said, well, actually this reaction is lasts a little bit longer, so 0.8 MeV, and then there's this exponential decay, making the fraction 1 over 7, and then the deuterium is eaten, and that creates the helium. Okay, so go through this picture, and if you want, you can go through the calculation again, but that's basically the idea. Okay, so now I give you the other picture, which is the second picture now, and that tells you what is the theoretical prediction of production of deuterium and lithium and helium in Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Okay, and so what you see, for example, for helium, if I have helium, and so what is here is this eta, is this baryon to whatever ratio, photon ratio. And so there is a precise prediction by cosmic microwave background what this eta is. So this is your observational constraint. On eta for helium, and then you also have observational constraints. So this is, how this is the mass fraction. And so you have observational constraint that is approximately 25% of helium. Okay, 25%. Okay. So you know that you should be somewhere here by observation. Now you can sort of start playing with this parameter eta, or with this parameter eta, for example, which precisely tells you about this asymmetry between the number of protons and antiprotons and stuff like that. Okay, and if you start, changing this eta, what happens is that, of course, this production of deuterium is suppressed. And if the production or enhanced. And if that is the case, of course, the number of helium will be different because that will change, how long I have to wait before I fuse helium, okay, from deuterium. And so it's obvious that if this eta is bigger and the reaction rate is proportional to eta, then I should have more. So this is the theoretical prediction theoretical predictions. And so what is actually surprising is that this theoretical prediction exactly agrees with these two observations. Okay, so for helium, we are in very, very good shape, and all the physics which I describe here actually seems, you know, seems fine. Okay, so now if you look at the middle picture, then you see that the same thing happens for deuterium. So exactly, you have, you know, two observational constraints for deuterium. You have, you know, the percentage which you observe, and then you have you know, the constraint on eta, and you see that the theoretical prediction, which now is the red line, exactly actually crosses that picture for deuterium. However, if you look at lithium, then you see a big problem there. And so you see that, so it should be somewhere this 10 to minus 10, where the two shaded regions actually cross. But the theoretical prediction is the red line. And so it's very, very much off. So I think it's actually a few times more. Okay. So the factor is approximately by 3. So deuterium is also okay, but lithium is a problem. And the of factor 3. So if you observe how much lithium is in the universe, and you compare that to your theoretical prediction based on you know, this known physics, then you get 3 times different result. So now, of course, this is a great opportunity for particle physicists and for people at PI actually to do some interesting physics. And so one person, if you're interested in this lithium problem, then the person to talk to is Maxim Pospelov here, who has been writing papers on this topic in the past 10 years or more. And so I, for example, encourage you to read very interesting recent paper, PRL paper, so PRL archive 15, then AA5, if you are interested. So basically what he does is that he postulates some new particle physics, if you want. And so you postulate some new particle or whatever, you postulate some of its properties, and then you check. Does it give me the right amount of lithium? That's the first thing, of course. And the second thing, if it doesn't screw up the results for the other elements, right? You still have to check that you're still getting the right number of helium and the right number of deuterium, and so on. And so this actually opens this, you know, very interesting discussion. And so something which you should really remember from this calculation is that the Big Bang nuclear synthesis really imposes, you know, very, very strong restrictions on your possible models of your pet theories of particle physics and other physics. And in some sense, it's really probing many different areas of physics. So let me just summarize what really entered the calculation. So Big Bang, BBM constraints fundamental physics so the final fraction F depends on many things. And so in particular, it depends on G star, which is the number of relativistic particles at the time of neutrino decoupling. So in some sense, if you create a theory, a new particle, you know, if you have new theory of some very nice particle, you should still consider whether, you know, it was relativistic or non-relativistic at this time. And if it was relativistic at the time, then actually it should contribute to this thing, and it should change G star. And if it changes G star, it will change the ratio. So actually, you cannot do, you know, you are very much constrained, actually, inventing new particles and stuff like that. OK, so this is the particle content at the time of neutrino decoupling. So really, if you want to invent something which doesn't screw up these things, you better do not change this G star, meaning you can invent a particle which was relativistic before for high energies, but not here. OK, similarly, of course, the calculation depends on the decay rate of the neutron. So you cannot also, you know, alter that. It depends on the difference between neutron and proton. So if you start changing the mass of neutron or start changing the mass of the proton, you should have very good reason to do that. It depends on this eta, which I showed you explicitly. So really, if you have different eta, you have different theoretical predictions for the abundance of things. But it seems that we know what eta is at this point very, very precisely, and it agrees for helium. Great. So you cannot, again, you know that there is 10 to 9 plus 1 protons. And you know, you have to explain that. Also, it depends on G Newton and G Fermi. And so many other things, right? So all these things from particle physics and from cosmology and all these quantities actually enter the calculation. And if you start changing one, then probably everything falls apart. So Big Bang nuclear synthesis is very, very restrictive, very, very strict constraint on your models of particle physics or cosmology. Questions? OK, so finally, if you turn your page, then on the other side is really, I think, the precise calculation, numerical calculation, what happens with various elements. And you can just look at that. And so the other elements are also included. So for example, you know, when the beryllium is produced and how it is produced and so on. So you can look it up. But that picture, I think, is really, you know, precise numerics. And it's not using even it's not using equilibrium thermodynamics. It's just, you know, full numerical calculation. And also you can read in the last paragraph is really why the dependence on eta is as it is. And so because you are fusing helium, really, you know, if you have bigger eta, it means you have more deuterium, or more quickly deuterium. And so it increases like that. OK, so let me stop here. And tomorrow we will start discussing CMB. Questions?
Like, I know it's a silly question, but it always comes to my head. Like, how do we know that aren't we missing, like, the region of the universe that we can observe is, I mean, limited? And how do we know that there are not chunks of antiparticles and antiparticle galaxies
in the hiding universe?
Yeah.
Well, you don't know, yes.
Yeah. And that could alter, like, all these things.
In principle, it could. And it's, of course, related also to the question of multiverse and stuff like that, where you could say, yeah, there's many other universes which actually have different things and different abundances and different physics. Yeah. So you cannot say. But you know, then you know, the question is, does it make sense to actually still discuss physics in some sense? Right? Because you can always say, well, what I see here. Well, in some sense, it can be that some extraterrestrial beings actually are projecting some movie for us on a globe, which is just, I don't know, several light years from us. And they are just projecting what we are supposed to see. But actually, the universe behind that movie screen looks completely different. Yeah. But you're right. So this is based on, you know, what we observe at this point. The best knowledge. So of course, for example, for this lithium, it is possible, you know, so there's this abundance which is measured, but it's possible that we haven't measured all the lithium, right? So you know, it's possible that the theoretical prediction for lithium is absolutely correct, that actually we don't need any new particles or new physics, it's possible that we just don't measure all the lithium, right? Maybe the lithium is hiding somewhere, as you are saying, and it's possible. Yeah.
Okay.